how factories have transformed Maine and the modern world, for better and for worse. The first modern factory was built almost 300 years ago in England. In 1721, the Derby Silk Mill opened, foretelling a new era in human history. Since then, innovations in technology, investment, and management have ushered in the modern industrial age. That silk mill led to cotton and woolen mills like those here in Maine. Then came iron and steel production, trains, cars, airplanes, the assembly line, then mega factories and modern electronics. Today, the Foxconn Technology Park in Shenzhen, China, is estimated to employ somewhere between 3 and 400,000 employees. The exact number is a secret. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with the author of a new book on the history of factories and how they've changed the world. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. All around the world, factories have given rise to entire cities. They've put people to work, and they've pumped out products that are integral to our lives, from shoes to automobiles. We'll learn more about how factories have shaped our society here in Maine and beyond, and implications for the future of factories. Joining me here from the NPR studios in New York City is Joshua B. Freeman. He is the author of several books on the history of labor and modern America. His newest book is Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. Josh is a distinguished professor of history at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and at Queens College. And joining me here in the studio, Jamie Rice, Director of Library Services at the Maine Historical Society. As always, we want to hear from you. Did you or your family members work in factories? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And we also want to mention that there is a wonderful factory-related video by Maine Public's Brian Bouchard that offers a peek inside the B&M Baked Bean Factory in Portland. And you can find that video on Maine Calling's website and on our Facebook page. Well, welcome to both of you, Josh and Jamie. And Josh, what's interesting to me about your book is that you acknowledge the profound good and bad of the rise of the factory, starting with the acknowledgement that despite what were often just deplorable conditions, factories have also contributed to the betterment of mankind.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fascinating thing, that they seem to have been so locked together. You know, the factory was a leading part of the Industrial Revolution that transformed our world and increased life expectancy and our standard of living and our comfort in a thousand ways. And yet, for many of the people who worked in the factory or whose lives were in other ways affected by the factory, this was not necessarily a great experience. It was often an experience of labor exploitation, of environmental damage to their communities, to disruption, to the loss of freedom. So it's a complicated history in which you can't easily tease the good and the bad away from one another.
And it's so interesting to me today, especially today in America, when, you know, a whole presidential campaign, one of the biggest themes was bringing back those factory jobs, that a factory job as, gosh, it's a different thing to a different person. To some people, that's a good job. And to some people, I mean, you talk about the first factory in the world was using children from what were basically orphanages.
Oh, it was very common to use various kinds of what I'd call unfree labor, people who didn't really choose to work there, whether it's children in the early English factories. There was some use of slave labor, including in the United States in factories, prison labor. All kinds of people were coerced because it was hard to recruit people voluntarily to go into these places. One big question, and maybe we could get to it later, is, you know, what makes a good job good? Why do we think about these as good jobs? And if they're not good jobs, how can we make them better jobs?
Jamie, much of Josh's book traces the history of the factory, not only in technological innovation, but also in size, how throughout history, to today when the Foxconn factories in China have tens or hundreds of thousands of workers, we think of Maine as not being a part of that, but there were some giant factories for their day right here in Maine, weren't there?
Absolutely. There were a number of different factories, mills, canning factories, all sorts of different activities. And they rose and they fall, and the population grew. But some of the largest manufacturing for textiles are early on were in Maine, and with lumbering and other activities. So you do see a huge influx, and population in Maine specifically did swell surrounding these factory towns, or what become these communities that are really focused and central for the factories.
The factory in Saco, Maine at one point was the largest. Was it cotton or woolen factory in the world?
A cotton, and you have to also think about is some of the resources that they're manufacturing or processing in these factories is not grown in Maine. So it also lends to the maritime economy, and the other aspects of the economy is that some things were imported and processed here. It's not just about taking the natural resources from the place where you are, but it puts you into the global economy or in the Western Hemisphere.
I want to ask you so much, Josh, but let's step away from Maine for a minute and step away from things like cotton and wool and go to Henry Ford's famous factory in Detroit. You know, all of us as kids learn about the factory and the assembly line, but do we really understand what that means? And I'm trying to flip open the book. You say Fordism built on two manufacturing innovations, interchangeable parts and continuous flow. Can you explain what that meant and why that was so transformative for America?
Well, prior to the beginning of the 20th century, if you were making a complicated thing like a gun or a sewing machine, you had a bunch of parts, but to put them together, it generally required skilled workers to fit all these pieces together so all these little intricate interactions would successfully work. The development of interchangeable parts so that every part was exactly the same from one gun or one sewing machine to the next was a necessary step towards our modern system and the assembly line. Because once you do that, then you can make a big pile of this part and of this part and this part and have relatively unskilled workers put them all together with no kind of final adjustment. And that's the first step, and it doesn't sound like much, but it requires a huge number of technical innovations to do that. And then Ford comes up with the idea of, instead of doing what they were doing when they first made things like cars, which is to get all these parts, it's like a big Lego set. You know, and you just make a pile of all the parts and you have skilled workers putting them all together. Instead, run the product as it's being put together in front of workers who stand still, mechanically running it in front of them, and each worker would just do one small piece in a process of highly subdivided labor. And this assembly line, as it became known, proved to be unbelievably efficient. So with the standardized parts and the assembly line, by the way, Ford, you know, made only one product, the Model T, when he developed the assembly line, so that, you know, you didn't have to have variation. It was exactly one car, just like the other, all black, one after another. And this enormous efficiency made the car from a luxury good to a mass product and became the model for industry after industry. It's our world today.
And the movement from using skilled laborers to unskilled laborers meant people didn't even have to speak English to work in one of these factories.
Absolutely. You still need skilled labor because you need people to build the machinery, but you needed less skilled labor. And on the production line, the skilled labor went much lower. And, you know, part of this was necessity because you couldn't get enough skilled workers to make all the cars that Henry Ford could sell. It was such a hit. In this era of mass immigration, it was immigrant workers primarily, or rural workers moving to the city, who manned the factories that made the cars and the appliances of that era.
And Jamie, it wasn't just in the major cities that we saw immigrants doing this work, did we?
Oh no, throughout Maine you see that, and it's a combination of the rural workers, of women coming to the urban cities, and working in the factories as the unskilled labor or being specifically trained in one activity where you have one role to play throughout the production of the goods, and seeing the influx of the of Canadian immigrants to the United States and then later from European immigrants. And then you start to get into the complexities of what that means for immigrant communities moving in and becoming part of the workforce, and sort of the social tensions that rise from that.
Yeah, let me just add that, you know, one part of the Ford system that we sort of forget is that Ford wanted to control the lives of these workers outside the factory as well as inside of it. And he was a big proponent of immigrants becoming what was called Americanized. So to keep your job at Ford, if you didn't speak English, you had to go to a Ford English school. And they actually had inspectors who went to workers' homes to make sure if they were living with a partner, they were actually married, that they were sober, and so forth. So, you know, a lot of the debates that we have today about assimilation and what it means to be an American have been associated with this recruitment of the factory workforce.
Jamie, we know that mills and factories in Maine built housing for their workers. Were there similar programs as there were in other parts of the country, like at the Ford factory, where it was more than just a place to live? You had to live a certain way?
Oh, absolutely. Maybe not less so in the Americanization that Ford implied, but certainly Americanization was a big part of Maine culture as you get into the turn of the century. But early on for Maine factories, we're talking about the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s, when they're sort of building these communities, especially for the women that were involved, there were social guidelines that you had to follow. There were curfews, there were activities, and there was behavior that was modified and curtailed based on at the discretion of the mill community. So there were housing communities. So it was controlled to a certain extent. And then later on, you start to see some of those restrictions lifted. But that's when the Americanization comes in. You start to see more families and more communities in these mill towns, these factory towns, and they it becomes a community unto itself with a very strict, it's like a huge neighborhood association, but just a lot stricter and a lot more invasive, but similar activities, yes.
Josh, here in Maine, as I'm sure you know, we've had some really devastating mill closures in the last couple decades. And this really, as I read your book, thought about how Maine reflects what goes on everywhere, doesn't it? That these mills are built, communities rise around them, but they don't last forever. They never last forever, do they?
No, absolutely. You know, it's an important point that you bring up, that there's a kind of life cycle to the factory, and that this model of the large factory has been sustained not by factories lasting three centuries, but by, you know, new cycles of factories developing elsewhere. So, you know, as far as I can tell, I think the very large textile complex in Saco was in operation something like 175 years. That's actually very unusually long for the history of a factory. But very typically, some of the, you know, heyday factories of their own age last, you know, 50, 60, 80, 100 years. And various things change. It was once a low labor region as a result of labor organizing or reformers, sees wages going up. You know, also you build these huge things, you put huge amount of money, investment in it. Then the owners get conservative. You know, they don't want to put more money in it, and new competitors arise elsewhere with newer technology, newer methods. So eventually you reach the downside, and that often has very devastating effects, particularly in the kind of communities that Jamie was talking about, which grow up around a particular factory. When that factory closes, you see a tremendous amount of physical and social wreckage.
Let's go back to what we touched on in the beginning. And Jamie, I'll start with you. This whole question of what makes a good job, and is a factory job a good job? Throughout Maine history, has it been considered a good job? Or not so much?
You know, we're working on a project with a Maine Memory Network called My Maine Stories, where we're capturing stories of individuals throughout Maine and their experiences. And one of our focuses has been around the paper mills and people who have worked in the paper mills and had those experiences, especially those that have recently closed. And more so than not, we hear about how it was a good job. I mean, there was economic opportunities that came with that. Families worked for generations in these mills, and you could make a really good living in what is otherwise a very rural area in Maine. So I think what qualifies, you know, then there's the flip side of it where they're loud, the working conditions may not be what some people would expect in a good job, but it's, you know, providing the opportunity for people to live and work successfully in a place where their family has been for generations, I think to many people, especially in Maine, is a good job. And to not have to leave your home, a place where you're, where you grew up, where your grandparents grew up, where your great-grandparents grew up, to be able to earn a decent living, I think is a lot of people do see as a good job. And there's a real sense of community, especially with the mills and the factories in recent memory of the people that we're talking to. It's a family, essentially. And when you lose that, it's emotionally difficult on top of being economically difficult. So I think in many ways, it's hard to define what someone sees as a good job, but we do get that sense from people that they really appreciate those opportunities.
Especially the jobs that were in the last century.
Especially the jobs within the last century. I mean, when you look further back and you with the working conditions and prior to labor unions and so forth, I mean, you really look at the details of that, as Professor Freeman was saying. But they still offered economic opportunity or opportunities to people who may not otherwise have had those opportunities. There's two sides to every coin in that respect.
Josh, what do you say is a good job?
Well, I agree with Jamie. I think a lot of when people think back on these jobs positively, they're thinking about is the way of life these jobs enabled them to live. You know, and particularly, I think in the quarter century after World War II, that's often our touchstone. You know, when you had American economic power at its height and unionization, which meant that workers were getting a larger share of the gains of this enormous efficiency, you know, it meant that for ordinary folks, every year was better than the last, that kids lived better lives than they did, things like vacations and car ownership and sending kids to college became possible. And it didn't necessarily meant that they liked working on the assembly line, putting, you know, a tire on a Chevrolet, you know, one time every 45 seconds, you know, but it was the way of life that job enabled them to have. That now seems kind of amazing in retrospect in many parts of the United States where those opportunities just aren't there anymore.
And the reality is for people working in these mega factories in other parts of the world now, these aren't necessarily good jobs.
No, you know, what got me thinking about this was a terrible incident that happened in China in 2010 when at the biggest Foxconn factory, a factory where they were assembling, you know, iPhones and iPads, young Chinese workers started committing suicide by jumping off the roofs of the buildings. And these were migrant workers, very much like the workers, you know, Jamie was talking about, coming from rural areas now in China instead of New England. Low pay, hard work, separated from their families, alienated by the circumstance. And, you know, it was a terrible incident, and it shed light on these places which had kind of been hidden in plain sight. On the other hand, rural workers continued to come to these places because they offered much better pay compared to the rural, poorer parts of China these workers were coming from. And also a little bit of a glimpse of a different world, you know, which I think was true for the New England young women, too. You know, you got off the farm, you saw something different. It was sort of social if you're with all these other young workers. So, you know, we're seeing the same pattern in much of the world today. And that's in the good places. You know, the worst places, like, for example, textile mills in Bangladesh, are truly horrifying. They're like the American sweatshops of 130 years ago.
All right. Well, we do have to take a quick break. There's so much to talk about. When we come back, we'll have your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Lunder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, always free and open to the public. And Deegan Wealth Advisors, an independently owned wealth management firm providing investment advice to individuals, families, and institutions. Information at DEIGHAN.com.
Public schools in Puerto Rico are getting a big reorganization both because and not because of Hurricane Maria.
Someone coming in and being honest and transparent about the why and making those tough decisions doesn't make it hurt any less.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Schools weathering a storm more than a decade in the making. That is next time on Marketplace.
Join us for the latest business news and analysis on Marketplace weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public is inviting high school students to join the second year of our Raise Your Voice workshops. It's 2 weeks of writing, making new friends, and creating multimedia. Participants will explore new ideas and writing techniques and gain valuable communication skills. These programs will take place at the University of Maine in Orono and at Baxter Academy for Technology and Science in Portland. They're free, and they'll run from July 23rd to August 3rd, from 8:30 in the morning to noon each day. Space is limited, so register early. Go to mainepublic.org and click under the Education tab for more details.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the impact that factories and mills have had in our society. Joining me in the studio, Jamie Rice. She's the Maine Historical Society, where she is Director of Library Services. And from the NPR studios in New York, Josh Freeman, a professor of history at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and author of several books on labor and modern America, including his recent book, Behemoth, which is all about factories. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now, Beth DeWolf, professor of history with the University of New England. Thank you for joining us, Beth.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
We've touched a little bit about the women who worked in the factories in New England, but I wanted to save some of that conversation for when you've joined us. Tell us about the quote-unquote mill girls. Who came to work not only in places like Lowell, Massachusetts, but also Saco, Maine, and Lewiston, Maine?
In the early period, from about the 1830s to 1850s, these mill girls were the daughters of farmers. They were future middle-class wives and mothers, and they were girls for whom factory work really put them out of their home-based jobs. So factories making things like textiles made their home labor superfluous. They no longer had to weave their own cloth. They no longer had to make their own candles, tasks that their mothers or grandmothers did. So to spend their time productively in between childhood and the year in which they would get married, these daughters, these best daughters of New England farmers, would head to the mills, earn a little money, do some productive labor, and prepare for marriage.
Mm. How long did this last, and who replaced the mill girls, and why?
This first generation of mill girls worked until about 1850, and then, by and large, they were replaced by immigrant labor. And a really interesting thing happens. This generation of young women are really the first generation to earn cash money for their labor, and they come to understand their own economic value. For example, girls will go to the mills, they'll earn their wages, and very dutifully send their money home to their families. But then they'll hold back a little bit because perhaps they need a winter coat or a new pair of shoes. And then perhaps they realize, you know, I work hard. Maybe I'll hold back just a little bit more and buy that pretty bonnet or pretty pin. So girls understand their labor, which then translates into wanting better working conditions, fewer hours, better wages, not being forced to live in mill-owned boarding houses. And so the young women begin to agitate. This does not make for a good, stable workforce from the perspective of the mill managers. And in fact, one of the very first labor strikes in Maine was in 1841 when the mill girls in Biddeford marched out of the factory, carried banners up Main Street that said, "We are not slaves," and demanded higher wages. It didn't work, but it set in motion ideas of getting more, And eventually that leads to a switching of the workforce from these no longer dutiful daughters of farmers to a much more docile and desperate workforce, immigrants.
Mm. Well, Beth, thank you so much for calling in. So interesting. Beth DeWolf, a professor of history at the University of New England. And Josh, your book is full of examples of workers who try to stand up for themselves. And not only do they not succeed because of the mill owners, but also because of whole society, including government and law enforcement, that's on the side of the mill owners.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes we have a false notion that economic developments happen in a kind of free marketplace on their own. But the factory as an institution only could arise with the support of government, with the support of laws and state power. And for decades, even centuries, that was used in part to restrain and control the workforce and prevent it from seizing too much power. Now, in the United States, that eventually changed. And by World War II, we saw a big transformation when industrial workers began to succeed in organizing. But that comes after long, bloody struggles over many, many decades.
And JB, here in Maine, a lot of long, bloody struggles.
Sure. And, you know, we were talking about the mill girls. When the mill girls start to be phased out because of the agitation, because of their requests, you see them largely replaced by French-Canadian immigrants. And then there continues to be this struggle between the American-born population and the French-Canadian, and then the struggles to advocate for better working conditions, but the willingness of the immigrant communities to cross the picket lines and to not join those agitations. And then you start to see the complexities with that. And then eventually you see the original wave of immigrants replaced by a new wave of immigrants from Europe. So it continues to move through this cycle. And when one workforce begins to notice their value or begins to advocate for their value, how quickly they can be replaced because of the nature of the unskilled labor, because of the nature of the industry that allows for quick replacement.
And Josh, we're seeing this now, right, when around the world, companies are just picking up and moving factories.
Oh, absolutely. You know, of course, in the United States, we think about, you know, oh, our jobs have gone to China or they've gone here or to Mexico. And sometimes that's true. But, you know, in China, for example, today, many of the factories built in the 1980s when China first opened up to foreign investment are now beginning to move their plants either to poorer parts of China with lower wages or places like Cambodia or Ethiopia or Bangladesh, which have much, much lower wages than in China. So again, it's what we were talking about before, this kind of cycle. And some of that cycle is this relentless search for low wages. And with our new technologies, you know, container shipping, the internet, and so forth, it's easier and easier to just pick up and move.
We'll start with Jim calling from Camden. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hey, great discussion today. I really wanted to call and ask about what happens to labor when computers can make soft goods such as suits and clothing, rather than the input of the labor is no longer required. So, and then just a quick comment. I was holding on the phone here and I was listening to your comments about waves of migrations. And to be honest, that sounds very familiar to me. Living in Union, Maine, 25 years ago, teenagers raked the blueberries. And over the last 25 years, I've seen their labor completely replaced by migrant workers. Because, to be honest, in my opinion, the blueberry owners right here in the Midcoast would rather have a professional migrant who they can, frankly, lean on rather than, you know, criticize or try to get the local, you know, hardware store owners, the local dentist's kid to rake blueberries. So it's kind of interesting. I'll take the answer off the phone.
Jim, thanks for your call. And Josh, let's go back to his first one. Let's talk about the future of factories and robotics.
Well, you know, clearly there's been technological change and advance, you know, since the beginning, and we're seeing new phases of it, and it does have big impact. But, you know, I think it's easy to overstress this. You know, there's been talk about post-industrial society for a half century, but we don't have that. In the U.S., the number of manufacturing jobs has shrunk a lot from, you know, about a quarter of all our jobs to now it's 8%. But worldwide, we're still in a heyday of manufacturing. And, you know, it was an interesting example that was brought up by the caller. A lot of garment manufacturing is still done by low-paid workers working on very simple sewing machines. And it's actually pretty tricky to automate something like making a high-end men's suit, you know. Now, there, of course, there are other products that can be quite successfully automated. So, you know, I think we're seeing the impact of automation, but it's not to simply wipe out this whole sector. It's to transform it. In the long run, will it reduce the worldwide number of jobs? Probably, but I don't think we're quite there yet.
Mm. Well, we'll move on to Larry calling from Falmouth. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I thought I would raise the history of the S.D. Warren paper mill in Westbrook. I grew up in Westbrook and also was a history teacher for a long time. And at one point, the S.D. Warren mill was generally looked at as being the single best paper mill going on in the world. And what I think was particularly interesting was the relationship that S.D. Warren, the owner, had and his management had with the rest of the people in the community, and that it was the responsibility of ownership to give back to the community and to the people that were working for them. And it wasn't a perfect system, but it worked and functioned very well for a long period of time. And then eventually, as seems to happen a lot of times, in 1967, the mill ownership passed over to first Scott Paper and eventually to Sappi. And as management moved away from the Westbrook community, so did the changing nature of the mill. And it shrunk down to just a minuscule amount of what it was at one point in time. So I just wanted to point that out. And that S.D. Warren, the man, Charles Scontris, an American historian, wrote a great article on S.D. Warren and his sense of Christian capitalism. And I would recommend it and maybe think that we should be looking back to that kind of a structure now. So I'll listen off air, and thank you very much for taking my call.
Thanks, Larry. And Jamie, you're collecting stories of people who've worked at S.D. Warren, aren't
yes.
you?
Yes. So, you know, these mill, S.D. Warren, Westbrook is a classic example, and I think another one is something like Millinocket, where you have a town and where you have, you know, it's a bit of a benevolent management situation where the giving back to the community and really recognizing the input the impact that the community has on the business and the impact that the business has on the community. But as these businesses are sold and as management moves away, you see less of that community relationship. And you see the same thing in Westbrook that you see in Millinocket, or you see in other mill towns where that that there's a becomes a disconnect between the worker community and the management. Now, that could be for a variety of reasons, but it demonstrates sort of the pull away from the community atmosphere, and then you start to see the community break down because if there's less people working and living in the community, then there's less goods and services being sold, and then you see these impacts as they start to pull away from this kind of community atmosphere.
And Josh, you write about an even bigger shift, not just that mills are being sold to owners that are out of state or out of the country, but that the owner itself is no longer in control of what happens in the mill, no matter who the owner is.
Well, you know, we have seen, particularly since the 1970s, what you could think of as a disaggregation, a taking apart of what were once all the same processes. You know, it used to be GE would design an appliance, it would make an appliance, it would market appliance. Today, we see those processes separated. So, you know, a company like Nike or even a company like Apple is basically a designer and a marketer, a brander. But they don't make computers. They don't make sneakers. They contract out with companies that you have never heard of. And these companies have the largest factories in human history. And we don't know who they are. And we don't know anything about them. Now, of course, companies like Apple and Nike, and there are a million others. I don't mean to just blame those two, you know, could assert a lot of control. And sometimes under criticism, they do. But not directly engaging in manufacturing gives them a kind of ability to distance themselves from the conditions under which it takes place and makes it harder to even know what's going on, let alone to manage it. And you know, just to go back to what was said in the, you know, in the last exchange about, you know, some of these paper mills in Maine, you know, it takes government investment, all of our investment, to make these factories possible, to build the roads and the electrical grids and the laws. And yet, somehow or another, it seems as if the public has no say in these decisions about, you know, relocating them or reorganizing them. And I think that's something we need to rethink. You know, corporations have rights, but they also have responsibilities.
Would you say that a company like New Balance, which is a shoe company that has a factory in Maine, is unusual in today's world?
New Balance is very unusual. They have chosen to manufacture some of their product in the United States, and of course they advertise that. It's a selling point for them. And there are other, you know, mostly niche companies that do that, but the lure of much cheaper, you know, labor is very great. And also, you know, a lot of manufacturing in the United States is so deteriorated, it's, in some industries, it's actually hard to do it here because we don't have the inputs anymore. You know, we don't have the suppliers and the knowledge. So when you begin to see a sector deteriorate, it's hard to build it up. But New Balance shows you can do it. And there are others that, in not only in apparel, but in other industries too, that have demonstrated that.
All right. Well, we do have to take another quick break. Before we do so, a word about tomorrow's program. We're going to learn about the art of the Wabanaki and its role in the community. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet us, post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Dean's Sweets, specializing in hand-dipped truffles, caramels, buttercreams, and other seasonal chocolates. In Portland and at deanssweets.com. And Elizabeth Drucker's Ballet School, presenting Cinderella, a ballet for all at Topsom's Orion Performing Arts Center, May 5th and 6th. Tickets at theballetschool.com.
John Brennan, who ran the CIA until last year, recently told MSNBC he thinks President Trump is afraid of President Vladimir Putin.
The Russians may have something on him personally that they could always roll out and make his life more difficult.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. I'll put my own questions to Brennan about the basis for that statement on Russia. Also, North Korea talks and the Iran deal. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30. Here on Maine Public Radio. Stay with us after Maine Calling for the Commonwealth Club of California. On today's show, it's a conversation with Maria Shriver, former First Lady of California, journalist and producer, founder of Women's Alzheimer's Movement, and the author of the book, I've Been Thinking, Reflections, Prayers, and Meditations for a Meaningful Life. That's coming up in about 20 minutes on the Commonwealth Club of California at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the importance of factories in our past and our future. Joining me today, Josh Freeman, who is professor of history and an author. His recent book about factories is called Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. And Jamie Rice is here. She's with the Maine Historical Society. Join our conversation. Our number, 1-800-399-3566. Jamie, I think we think a lot about Maine in terms of the mills that turned out textiles, the mills that made shoes, the lumber industry. But I was surprised to learn that Portland, Maine had a gum factory.
Yeah, absolutely. Spruce gum was manufactured. So gum wasn't necessarily invented in Maine, but was started the mass production of gum. Not very good gum, if you've ever had any. But
doesn't sound good.
No, but still gum nonetheless. And it's actually down on 4th Street where near where the Hub Furniture is today. But lots of really interesting things. Corn canning was a huge production in corn canning in Maine. There was silk manufacturing in Westbrook, which I find really fascinating to think that we've been manufacturing American silk here. And toothpicks in Phillips, Maine. There's lots of different pieces that I don't think we kind of get overlooked because maybe their time was short or, you know, the industry kind of came and went. But there's some really fascinating aspects of industrial history in Maine.
Elaine writes on Facebook, my Polish grandmother, who spoke almost no English worked in Sacco's Pepperell Mill, a miserable place, I was told. As a boy, my father would deliver her lunch. He was fond of telling us how she would say to him, "Study hard in school so that you don't have to work here." He did, went on to earn a master's in education and taught high school civics for 30 years. That's an American story, isn't it, Josh?
You know, it's beautifully put, and I think it really captures a lot of what this experience was. And it shows, you know, what we were talking about before. It was a good job because her son didn't have to take the job. You know, it's an irony there.
Email from Fred. For what it's worth, my understanding is that the interchangeable parts were first developed by Eli Whitney. Think Pratt & Whitney today in the manufacture of rifles for the Union Army in the Civil War, a major factor in the outcome of the war. Before that, weapons and everything else were made by individual craftspeople and unique to that shop. You're right about that, Josh.
Yeah, I do. And it is certainly it's not just that one company, but it's the armaments industry which first developed interchangeable parts. And this requires, you know, being able to machine parts to very fine tolerances. And, you know, it's interesting it's this industry because in the short run, interchangeable parts was actually more expensive. It was difficult to do. You needed skilled workers to implement. It was very hard. The Army, unlike a private company, didn't really care about profit. You know, they wanted guns that could be easily repaired, that you know, you could take a replacement part. So they helped finance what was called, you know, armory methods before the Civil War. And then that spread to other industries. It spread to sewing machine making, and it spread to bicycle making, and then eventually to the auto industry. But, you know, even as late as the late 19th century, early 20th century, big companies like, you know, like Singer Sewing Machine and even Ford still were struggling to make truly interchangeable parts. When Ford finally did, they were so proud of it. I ran into one pamphlet where they said, if you're driving a Ford Model T anywhere in the car in the world, and you see another Model T, you could take your crankshaft and exchange it with the other car, and both of you would drive away as if, you know, nothing had ever happened. Because it was an incredible accomplishment to achieve this. It's something, of course, today we think nothing of. But
that's right. It's hard for us to get our heads around that because that's how the world works today.
And I think something else from the comment from the email is that you see the shift from the skilled craftsman and shifting into the larger industrial production. But now in our modern times, you see sort of the shift back. And I know especially here in Maine where the craftsman who's making that individual piece, that custom piece, or craft distilleries, or a custom artistry, you see kind of people are looking for that kind of customization and getting away from the mass-produced product. So you can kind of see the ups and downs of the expectations of the consumer, which in many ways really drives what we're talking about.
We're going to go to Patrick calling from Portland. Hi, Patrick. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. Great show today. I'm calling in because I'm working on building a new kind of factory in Maine. We're a makerspace, which is a community workshop that provides our members with access to industrial tools and workspace. We're opening a wood and metal shop right in Portland, and you can find out more about us at factory3.org.
Patrick, thanks so much for calling in, and I invite you to put information on the Maine Calling Facebook page. But this is kind of what you're talking about, Jamie.
Right, giving people an opportunity. And actually, I've seen the flyers for that particular woodworking place. But giving people the opportunity to be able to use tools and resources that they might not otherwise have to kind of hone their craft. And people are looking for these custom-made pieces and kind of searching out for that more skilled pieces that they wouldn't normally find from mass production.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I sort of stumbled on some precedents for this very early in the history of factories, which surprised me. I didn't know about them. Like some of the earliest metalworking factories in England were not what we think of as a factory building and it's owned by one company and everyone in the building works for the same company. But you would have power equipment, a steam engine, and it would run through belts and shafts, all kinds of machinery. And individual workers would rent a room in the factory with access to that power. And then they would have their own lathes or whatever it is. So, you know, it suggests that there are possibilities for combining the efficiencies of working together and of high technology with some of that individual craftsmanship. And, you know, now whether that could meet all of our needs and desires, I don't know. But I think it's very exciting to see people going back to experimenting with different models.
Patrick, thanks for your call. We're going to move on to Steve, who's calling from Rockland. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a quick question for your panel. I'm curious about unions and the impact on the rise or demise of U.S. manufacturing, whether or not we have the, you know, we've created the right balance of worker rights, safety, and product and wages, or we swung too far and that's impacted productivity and caused us to make it more economical to go elsewhere.
Well, I think unions helped improve factories in the United States in the mid-20th century in conditions and safety and so forth. And unionized factories tended to have higher productivity than non-unionized factories. Nonetheless, factory owners, GM and GE and Ford, who had built these giant integrated complexes, discovered that what they thought was a great advantage could be a great danger, because if you could shut down the one factory that made every Chevrolet engine, you know, which happened to be in Flint, Michigan, you could shut down virtually all of GM, you know. So American companies, in response to unions, began decentralizing, first within the United States. And that's one reason why, you know, factory size in the United States shrank after World War II, reversing what had been the general tendency, whereas in other parts of the world, factories continued to grow. Today, you know, for better or for worse, most unions are pretty weak, and I don't think that the obstacles to American manufacturing primarily come from the labor movement.
And in earlier, one of the callers earlier had mentioned Charles Contras, and he's a labor historian. And I think, and he's published excellent articles and books on the labor movement in Maine, which I think follows the traditional national pattern of the rise of the labor movement, of the labor unions, and then sort of their impact today. So I think Maine, in general, follows that national trend with those, with some uniqueness.
Steve, thanks for your call. We're going to go up to Rangeley and Janice. Hi, Janice. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm calling about from a business that was in Providence, Rhode Island, Providence being the whole geographical area of the entire state of Rhode Island, nearby Connecticut and Massachusetts and New York City, and that was the costume jewelry business. My word, that employed millions and millions of people.
Janice, did you work in a big factory or did you do piecework?
No, I'm an industrial designer, so I worked in several factories doing design work because I understood the production, and I could then draw something which is made then by a model maker, and they'd make the mold out of it and use other pieces.
And did you feel as though these were good jobs?
Yeah. I mean, by now the EPA has come in and cleaned up the water and the pollution that were put out from plating, and they had bathrooms and lights and fans and air conditioning and all that sort of thing. And it was like a home atmosphere. They had birthday parties and celebrations, and almost every day, for some reason, a bouquet of roses or something was delivered.
Interesting. And this is just in the last 50 years or so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, Josh, is this a factory, a part of the industry you're familiar with, the costume jewelries?
I am. And, you know, it's very different from what I write about in my book, because it's an industry. And as your caller said, you know, Rhode Island was a big center of it. Newark, New Jersey had some of it, too. That's a different model. We actually often have a lot of small factories that are kind of clustered together. And there's a lot of flexibility. You know, Ford could make, you know, Model Ts incredibly efficiently, but all it could make was Model Ts. You know, in costume jewelry, you're constantly having different designs, different fashions, different products. So the smaller, more nimble, more flexible company clustered together with all the different suppliers and specialists that they need, the industrial district, is a whole other approach to manufacturing that we've seen in different kinds of product lines. And I think it's a very, very interesting story, and one in which I think there's maybe more possibilities for reviving in a lot of the country, again, because it kind of is a niche type of industry that can move into various opportunities.
Janice, thanks so much for your call. Before we go, Josh, I want to ask you, one of the big conversations going on in our country today is how states compete with one another to attract these big new factories, whether it's a airplane parts manufacturer or a car factory, an automobile factory. And, you know, big victories are proclaimed when one gets built in Mississippi or South Carolina or something like that. From looking back at the history of factories, what would you say to governors of states that are trying to attract these factories?
Well, you know, from the individual governor's point of view, it might make sense. From our society's point of view, this is crazy. You know, why would we be using our tax money to get a company to move from one state to another? It just doesn't make sense to me. And you know, we know that factory is going to eventually close also, you know, and what's it going to leave behind? So, you know, Wisconsin has recently pledged $3 billion to attract the Foxconn factory. And, you know, I am in favor of trying to promote more manufacturing in the United States. But I think instead of having states compete with, against each other, it would be great if we use that money to invest in vocational training, in improved infrastructure, in innovation research that would draw all kinds of manufacturing and maybe a varied mix of manufacturing rather than to sort of basically pay a huge bribe to get one company to build one single giant factory that 20 years later may decide to, you know, put itself up for auction all over again.
Do you feel as though we haven't learned the lessons of the past?
Well, in that sense, I guess I do, frankly. You know, I think that, you know, maybe in our yearning for some of the good sides of what manufacturing once brought to this country, we're kind of pursuing slapdash policies that aid the companies, and they do help communities, don't get me wrong, but we're investing so much in this one, you know, tactic, and maybe there are better ways to spend our tax money.
All right. And before we go, Jamie, tell us about some of the resources. How can people learn more about manufacturing and factories in Maine?
Well, our website, the Maine Memory Net, Maine Memory Network, which is mainmemory.net, we have a variety of resources about the different types of manufacturing industry in Maine. And through our community partners, there's a considerable amount of collections online where people can explore the different communities or the different industries and really learn about the history of Maine manufacturing. And I think that speaks directly to what we were just saying, is that taking the lessons of the past and looking at the investments that Maine throughout its history has made to this side, and to also learn the impacts, environmental, social, economic, and if we continue to reinvest in this, being prepared for when the industry moves on or changes in a way so that we don't have the impact to our communities that we're seeing now or that we've seen in the last 50 years. So taking the resources that you can find at a place like Maine Historical Society and putting them to use and a better understanding of how to look towards our future.
Well, thank you both. What a great conversation. That was Jamie Rice, Director of Library Services at Maine Historical Society. Also with us today, Joshua B. Freeman, Distinguished Professor of History at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and at Queens College. He is the author of Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. And for an inside look at a Maine factory that's hasn't changed in a lot of years, check out Maine Public's Out and About video on the B&M Baked Bean Factory. It's posted on Maine Calling's website and on our Facebook page. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.